Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's episode features the phenomenal Justin Fox, chatting about his latest book, The Wolf Hunt. The Wolf Hunt is the second book in the thrilling Jack Pembroke series, each of which is a standalone story. In this book, Lieutenant Jack Pembroke moves from England to South Africa, where he commands an anti-submarine flotilla in Cape Town. He must quickly prepare his men for Nazi U-boats threatening the vital Cape convoy route during the World War II. When Rommel's forces activate in North Africa, this sea route is crucial for Allied supplies. The enemy, led by Captain Wolfgang Brandt, also carries a South African spy intent to sabotage. Jack's mission to escort a convoy to Durban while evading U-boats becomes a tense cat-and-mouse game, pushing him and his men to their limits in The Wolf Hunt. In this episode, Justin is in conversation with novelist and lecturer Dr. Ronald Irwin. Enjoy.
Good afternoon. My name is Ron Irwin. I am a media studies lecturer at the University of Cape Town and a novelist and a writer. And I'm here with Justin Fox, who is a Cape Townian travel writer, a novelist, and a photographer. He's a UCT graduate and a Rhodes Scholar, attaining an MA and a doctorate in English from Oxford University. He's a former editor of Getaway International magazine. His photographs and articles have been published internationally. Justin's written over 20 books, and they include works of fiction and nonfiction. To mention a few, The Marginal Safari, Cape Town Calling, Whoever Fears the Sea, and The Impossible Five. He's a two-time Mondy Journalism Award winner, and his works have been listed for the 2011 Alan Paton Award for Nonfiction, the 2012 Schreiner Prize for Literature, and a 2014 Edestat Prize for Literature. His most recent nonfiction book, Place, has been a tremendous success and is now into its sixth printing. And now, South Africans can pick up The Wolf Hunt, a naval war story that will have you up late reading, even if you don't know your starboard from your port. It's now available in all good bookstores across South Africa. Justin, welcome.
Thanks so much, Ron. Good to be with you.
Congratulations on the publication of your new novel, again, The Wolf Hunt, which is the second in the Jack Pembroke series of World War II naval adventures based off Cape Town. This seems to be a standalone work. You don't need to have read the first novel to enjoy it. The Wolf Hunt, as well as its predecessor, entitled The Cape Raider, is set against romance, skullduggery, and seafaring combat of World War II. As Bill Nason, author of South African at War, 1939 to 1945, points out in the cover shout, if you thought that the epic sea war of the 1940s meant the North Atlantic or the Pacific, think again. The coast and waters around the southern tip of Africa also swirled with menace. Fox uses his gift for evocative description and eye for striking detail to weave an exhilarating story, bringing to life the sights, sounds, and mix of people pitched into hostilities at sea as well as on land. I know you've always been interested in both World War I and World War II, Justin, and you yourself served in the South African Navy. But this novel and its predecessor seem to be somewhat of a departure for you, not least because they are firmly war novels in a very defined genre. On the other hand, you seem to have a real attachment to the sea in general, given that one of your formal novels was entitled Whoever Fears the Sea, which is based off Kenya and did not have this World War II connection. What made you want to write a series of war novels based upon real events off Cape Town, especially World War II war novels?
Ron, the easy answer is that I've got a love affair with the sea. I live next to a lighthouse in Cape Town. I'm absolutely obsessed with the sea. I'm a windsurfer and a sailor and a surfer. So there's the passion of the sea is the bedrock. And whether I'm writing fiction or nonfiction or poetry, I often return to the theme of the sea. So that's an abiding love and passion with me. I grew up sailing boats in False Bay out of Simonstown, yacht club, dinghies and rowing boats and scuba diving and sailing and Hobie cats and keelboats. So there's always been that interest and love. And then also as a kid, I used to read a lot of the sort of a boy's own annual adventure stories, all of them set in the Second World War, just about. And later I read the kind of Nicholas Monserrats and Douglas Riemanns and fell in love with that kind of storytelling. Alistair MacLean's Guns of Navarone, those kinds of books and movies were a passion for me when I was a teenager. And what always disappointed me was that none of them ever featured South Africa, and none of them ever featured the biggest Royal Navy base in the Southern Hemisphere, which was Simonstown. And I think partly that was because most of those books were written in the 60s and 70s during apartheid, and none of those authors wanted to touch the pariah state that was South Africa. But also, as you mentioned earlier, the focus was the North Atlantic, the Pacific, and the Mediterranean. And so they didn't pay much attention to the Cape and what was happening in South African waters. So what I wanted to do was to write that kind of novel, that kind of 1960s, 70s novel, almost paying homage to the tradition that I fell in love with as a kid, but set it in South Africa with South African heroes and South African ships. So that was the project behind this. And I've written two books now, and I'm going to keep going. I think I'm enjoying the journey tremendously.
Wonderful. Just for some readers who really are coming into this cold, the novel's entitled The Wolf Hunt. But there's no wolves in this story at all. I checked. Can you please explain to us why a novel about subs and ships is entitled thus? And what is a wolf pack in this regard?
Yeah, Ron, during the First and then much more so in the Second World War, the Germans were trying to find the best way to use their submarines to destroy Allied shipping and ships, which was effectively more powerful than the German Navy. So they were trying to devise ways to use their submarines. And Admiral Dönitz, the head of the submarine fleet in the Second World War, he was instrumental in trying to micromanage exactly how his U-boats performed. And so he tried to gather them into groups, packs. One U-boat would sight a convoy, and then it would radio back to headquarters, and then all the U-boats in that sector would be vectored in upon that convoy. And they'd wait until they'd assembled a pack of, say, five or six U-boats, and then they would attack together, usually at night. And Dönitz lovingly called his U-boats his U-boats captains his wolves. And so this idea of hunting in a pack at night for much of the war was a very effective way of sinking the greatest number of Allied ships without losing too many U-boats in return.
We're going to talk more about the excitement and the horror of that kind of combat. I visited Kiel, Germany, with the northern part of Germany years ago, and that was where the main U-boat base for the Nazis was. The U-boat bunkers are still there, and they rise ominously out of the water. The specter of the submarine, or the U-boat, is a nefarious one. One thinks immediately of the film and novel Das Boot, as well as any number of submarine books and novels, when not only are the subs bringer of sudden deaths, but the crews themselves are under terrible pressure, both literally and figuratively. The Cruel Sea by Nicholas Montserrat is one such novel, and one nonfiction book is simply entitled Iron Coffins. So it's a dark subject, and it's an exciting subject. What place does the submarine hold in war literature, in your opinion, and why is there still this fascination?
The submarine holds an enormous, a disproportionate place in war literature. If you look at the literature of the Second World War, the number of submarine novels and movies and short stories are nonfiction books, etc., are just incredible. And I think this can be attributed to a number of factors, but one of them is the sheer horror that Allied sailors had to experience in say, for instance, crossing the Atlantic, never for a moment knowing at what time of day or night a torpedo might sink their ship underneath them. So it was constant, permanent terror, really, for those sailors. Many of them never took their clothes off, never took their life jackets off, didn't even want to go to their cabins because, you know, those ships could go down in a matter of a couple of minutes if they were struck correctly by a torpedo. So I think for thousands, hundreds of thousands of sailors and people who crossed the oceans on ships during the Second World War, and remember, thousands of ships came around the coast of South Africa, most of them trying to avoid submarines. And for all these crews and passengers, the indelible impression of this lurking menace below the waves was something that found its way into fiction and nonfiction in a huge way. Similarly, the heroism and terror of being in a submarine. You're an incredibly effective fighting machine, but you're tremendously vulnerable to depth charging. And when you do go down, and when you are hit, basically every single one of you on board that submarine is going to die a terrible death, with a submarine sinking to the ocean floor, and none of you are going to get out alive. And so for all the submariners, and the highest attrition rate in the Second World War was amongst German U-boat sailors, the terror for them must have been unimaginable. And so those who did survive were able to write the most harrowing and horrific accounts of submarine warfare. But then, of course, there's heroism on both sides. And for those sailors in those U-boats, maybe months away from home, if you're fighting off Cape Town and you're wanting to head back to France or Germany in your submarine, you're away for many, many months because a submarine is an extremely slow vehicle. The stories of those journeys for those who survived are epics of the sea, absolute epics. And so this is fabulous raw material for a writer like me. All the accounts that I read are utterly riveting.
And just to say, I was to think a 7-week trip from Europe to Cape Town in a submarine must have just been unbelievable, as you relate in the novel. Technology played a crucial role in the Battle of the Atlantic. And of course, with submarines, with advancements in radar and sonar and code breaking shaping the course of the conflict, you focus on certain technology that's used to detect subs, new technology that was apparently tested out in Simonstown Harbor. How did you incorporate these technological developments into the narrative? And more importantly, I suppose, how did you use technology to increase the tension? The way the destroyers would hone in on the subs using certain technological advancements. Could you just lead us through that?
Yeah, Ron, I looked very closely at the different phases of the war as one side got a slight advantage. The advantage would then quickly swing back to the other side. So it was a technological, a ding-dong battle through the war. In the early years, the Germans clearly had the advantage. Towards the end of the war, they never quite caught up with each time the British and the Americans advanced a little bit further. And I looked very closely at a captain called Frederick John Walker, a Royal Navy captain, and he was the sort of the brains trust early in the war, trying to figure out ways to counter the German U-boat threat. And I looked at his methods, and my hero, Jack Pembroke, strangely follows exactly the kind of patterns of thought that went through Walker's mind. And one of them was to try and hunt for a submarine in a hunter-killer group so that you leave some of your ships to look after the convoy and you have a few extra warships to go hunting submarines. In other words, a hunter-killer group. Then you also have the idea of that he developed of holding a submarine down. So you keep dropping a depth charge near where you think the submarine is so he can never surface. And you keep in that area maybe for a day or two. So eventually the submarine runs out of air and has to surface, and then you've got him. Another tactic he used was called the creeping attack, where he would use a submarine would be picked up on a sonar, and one ship would hold it in its sonar, and another ship would sneak up and attack it. And there were many variations on that kind of attack. And so strangely, my hero also develops this kind of technique. I do try and follow very loosely the kind of advancements in submarine warfare of the first couple of years of the Second World War.
I have to say that the passages in your novel, and I'm going to read a few out later on in this podcast, where the submariners are subjected to depth charges and they either have to escape by going extremely too deep into the water, which risks imploding the sub, or again, coming up to the surface, which is an important plot point in the novel, is beyond riveting. It's terrifying. If you have any propensity towards claustrophobia, I suggest you get yourself a hot cup of cocoa before you read those sections. It's absolutely I don't want to use the term barbaric, but it seems almost barbaric and immensely cruel. But of course, the cruelty goes in both sides. You know, one of the things about this novel, you've written 20 plus books, you have published magazines, you've been in the writing game probably as long as you can remember, and you have been recognized for the excellence of your work, of course. Now, these books, however, this book and the Cape Raider, the Jack Pembroke series, which is now looks like it's set to continue, have been enormously popular, not just in South Africa, but also overseas, particularly in England. Were you prepared for that popularity? After all, seafaring World War II novels set off South Africa don't seem at first glance to be bestseller material. We live in a world where bestseller material seems to be young wizard boys and girls and possibly strange people living in New York. Who knows? But no, this is a good old-fashioned seafaring World War II yarn, and by goodness, people seem to love it. You have over 1,000 reviews on Amazon, any other measurement you'd like to use. The books are, to use a hackneyed term, flying off the shelves. You have droves of readers. Are these readers all World War II fundies? Where are they? Is it attracting people? You don't need to know that much about World War II to enjoy the novel. And I think that's the trick. I know a little. I'm interested in it. They say after you turn 50, you have a choice. You can develop a hobby or get into World War II. And, I am interested in World War II, but I'm not by any chance historically well versed. I had no idea that this type of activity was happening off of Cape Town. I always thought Cape Town was sort of a sleepy port that had a nice dog and a couple cannons and that's it. And my goodness, that's not the case at all. Are your readers World War II buffs, history buffs, man or woman or person on the street? Who are they?
Ron, the demographic split is sort of between America and the United Kingdom are my... The bulk of my readers are there. I can see that from all the returns I get. So I'd say mostly British and American, and then quite a lot of Canadian and Australian. This is not surprising given the passion for the Second World War in those communities. You just need to look at Steven Spielberg with things like Saving Private Ryan or Band of Brothers or Masters of the Air, how these become box office bestsellers. So that's obviously where the real passion for the Second World War is, and consequently where the majority of my readers are. I don't have that many South African readers, strangely. It hasn't taken off here yet. I hope it does. As to what kind of readers, I would say, yeah, a lot of fundies, a lot of from the comments I get on Amazon, I can see they're older chaps who really know their stuff. And boy, if you put a foot out of line with the smallest little detail that is maybe marginally off, they jump down your throat, which is fantastic. It means you've got very active readers who are nitpicking, which is a privilege to have. So I'd say mostly foreign, mostly British and American, mostly men. But then again, I do have quite a lot of women readers, and when women do get to my books, they say they enjoy them. So I think there must be enough in them, enough of the other stuff that isn't World War II anorak to interest a wider readership.
It's, you know, you say that readers are very demanding when it comes to this work, that you have a real chore in front of you, a real task, because you can't make stuff out of whole cloth. You have to have every single element has to be right. And it really is right. It reeks of reality. It is down to the smell of the socks of the Mariners and the subs, where they place the onions on top of the torpedoes. All of those details just seem incredibly right. And I can see online that your readers agree. And I think that's a really important achievement, to be able to work seamlessly, all those details, historical details, technical details, into a narrative and keep that narrative moving. You know, last time I felt this way about a novel, I must say, was The Hunt for Red October by Tom Clancy. When that novel came out, of course, it was about the 1980s. They made a film out of it. But there's a lot of technological marvels to nuclear subs that you picked up as you read the book. In fact, I think he tried to sell it to a naval publisher before it was picked up to a mainstream publisher, because it was beyond just a kind of fundies book. It's also a book for the lay reader who's going to sit there and really be thinking, wow, submarines are actually pretty interesting. One thing is, I've lived in Cape Town for over 30 years, and I really was never so aware of just how big a part these waters played in the war effort and how dangerous they were. Your work features destroyers and combat vessels, as well as nefarious German subs lurking below, all within sight of familiar landmarks to Cape Townians. How close is all of this to actual historical reality? For instance, did we really have subs off the coast of South Africa? Did German spies really get landed on our shores, right up the West Coast, in places that we can all easily recognize and often go to on holiday? Was that all happening? I'm not going to provide spoilers. I'm simply going to mention these things because it's quite obvious that's what happens.
Absolutely, Ron. I thought I knew as well, but when you start digging, it is astonishing how many German U-boats were operating off the Cape Coast, and for how much of the war, and how devastating they were. And yes, German spies were landed on the coast. So I stick resolutely to the truth. Well, and then I fictionalize it. So did German U-boats creep into Table Bay and look at what was happening in Cape Town docks and sit on the bed of Table Bay during the day and then pop up and watch the bright lights of Sea Points? Absolutely they did. Did they sink ships within sight of Cape Town? Yes, they did. A German U-boat was sunk just north of where I'm sitting right now. Dustin Island, which is just north of Robben Island, was sunk by a British destroyer, HMS Active. So not only were the Germans sinking ships, but the South Africans or the Royal Navy were sinking U-boats in our waters. To give you an idea of the numbers, 150 ships were sunk in South African waters, of which more than 100 were sunk by German U-boats off our coast, which is a staggering number. And then as to the truth about spies being landed off our coast, the famous Afrikaner Nazi Roby Leibrandt was landed on the West Coast, created a small band of far right-wing fascist terrorists, was involved in a sabotage campaign, and was eventually caught and arrested and charged for treason. So that sub-theme in the book of an Afrikaner Nazi being landed on the coast is also very close to the truth.
100 boats, unbelievable. It's a piece of history I really did not know much about. I want to talk about now, I want to shift over to the genre of storyteller you've embraced here. In my mind, it's very much within the realm of Patrick O'Brien and Dewey Lambden, Chris Durbin, Douglas Rieman, Max Hennessy. Your writing really gets into the nitty-gritty details of ocean battle over 80 years ago. The details are astounding, but I should emphasize they are seamlessly sewn into the narrative, so we don't interfere with the pacing of the plot. I know very little about naval battles, but I was really transported here. I'm going to give you a small example of how you can build, or how you build, excitement as well as technical and historical know-how into just a small passage. Control room hands open the vent levers. This is a sub gliding underwater. Control room hands open the vent levers, and the air that gave U-68 buoyancy escaped from the ballast tanks with the sound of stampeding horses. Kruger stepped into the control room and watched as the planesmen tilted their four planes to hard dive and the other planes to 10 degrees. He felt the bows lean toward the ocean floor, watched as the needle on the depth gauge kept slowly round, and listened as the sound of the sea slapping against the hull was replaced by silence. No diesel pumping, no wireless noise, no droning of ventilation fans. It was like being part of a magic trick. How on earth do you get these details right? The emotional details, as well as what it would feel like to be in a sub that you obviously could never have been in, although you might have seen them in a museum or, I don't know, in a video or something like that, but it really transports you. But still, you need to know what a plainsman is. You need to know what the air would sound like leaving the tanks. You need to understand what degree it sinks in. Who knows that? How do you know that he's going towards the ocean floor? He might even land on the ocean floor. How do you know that it goes down in silence and the diesel stops when the sub goes underwater? I did not know that. I would have been very nervous if I were a submariner and they turned off the engines and went underwater. I would have thought, keep the engines on just in case. How do you get that all right? What do you do?
Ron, I'm an archive nerd. So I spend months and months researching. I don't like writing. I find writing extremely painful and difficult, but I love research. So I spend way longer on the research than I do on the writing. So I go to London every year for a few months, and I plunder the Imperial War Museum archives and the National Archives in Kew, and I go down to Greenwich and down to Portsmouth to the Naval Archives. I spent a lot of time in Simonstown with the Simonstown Navy Archives and the Town Archives. I also go up to Pretoria to the Department of Defense to get the South African Naval Archives there. And they have files written by German U-boat commanders giving personal accounts of their time off the South African coast. So a lot of this stuff is me not reinventing the wheels. If I find an account by a German captain talking about diving in Table Bay and sitting on the ocean bed, and his diary is incredibly detailed, then there's my raw material. I can tweak it a bit and fictionalize it a bit, but I get a lot of the stuff right by making sure it is as close to the kind of accounts that I'm reading. As for the kind of emotional stuff, it's you know, I'm claustrophobic. I'm terrified of being underwater or trapped underwater. So I'm channeling my own fears and filtering them through the facts that I'm picking up in the archival research. And then I also get lots of readers to check me out. I've got a retired admiral and submariners that read my text before I send it to a publisher, and they are brutal. You know, they don't let me put a foot out of line, and for that I'm extremely, extremely grateful. And also what I do is I have a South African non-submariner on board the submarine, and he's the idiot. So everybody has to explain to him what's going on, and he's terrified of everything he sees. So he is representing the reader, really, and that's a useful device for having to explain to the South African on board the German submarine what's going on, and hence explaining to the reader.
Without giving too much away of the plot, the novel hinges partly upon an Afrikaans spy with heavy Nazi sympathies. How historically accurate was it to say that there was a significant number of Afrikaners during World War II who actually were very much on the Nazi side? Can you walk us through this?
Yeah, Ron. During the 1930s, the rise of Hitler and what was happening in Germany was very popular all over the world, all over Europe, and certainly amongst the Afrikaans community in South Africa. They were hugely inspired what they saw in Germany. As to the heavy Nazi stuff, the Osewar Brandwach was a cultural organization that had 300,000 members on paper, and they were very far right leaning at times. But it was only that the splinter groups of really militant hardcore Nazis in that group that could be considered to be what we might call kind of pure fascist or pure Nazi. And so it's estimated that there's probably only 1,000 or 2,000 really hardcore guys that were prepared to start a civil war. They were prepared to commit sabotage around the country, and they were dyed-in-the-wool Nazis. And the rest were fellow travelers. So there was a lot of support amongst the Afrikaners for Hitler, certainly early on, but that did dwindle. Unfortunately, what happened when the Nationalists came to power in 1948 is a lot of the very hardline Nazis got a lifeline. And in fact, both two of our prime ministers, B.J. Forster and P.W. Botha, were very heavily involved in the very far right-wing elements within the OB. And I would say B.J. Forster was you know, basically a Nazi, yeah, certainly in the late 30s and early 40s. So those are the themes I try and pick up in the novel.
The novel is not all technical, and it's not all just subs going underwater and people being shot. There's a really, really, and I found it very surprising, lyrical element to this fiction. There is a point where you depart, I think, from the, you know, from the technical, the dials and the levers and the planes and the depth charges and the radar, and you get into the feelings of being in this high pressure combat situation. I want to just touch on that. I was pleasantly surprised to come across many, many passages like this. I just want to expose the listeners to this. This is a person this is one of your characters who's trying to get his head around the fact he's actually sitting in a sub and he's underwater and he's never done this before. And, you know, as you say, that character is a stand-in for us. His fear is our fear. His perceptions are perceptions. And of course, I can hardly imagine what it must have been like to go underwater in a U-boat. And this is his thought. He could not help but think of the submarine as a whale-like creature filled with veins and arteries, nerves, lungs, a complex circuitry connected to the brain and its commander with a single eye on the end of a long proboscis that had reached above the waves. And then their depth charge. Now we're in the middle of a situation where depth charges, these explosions, are falling around them underwater. At any moment, they could all die. And everybody's terrified on board the sub, and they're being pushed further and further downward. Time let go of its moorings. He imagined a U-68, lifeless and spent on the ocean floor, 100 years hence. 2041. Inside her belly lay 51 bodies, perfectly preserved in their tomb, corpses of papery flesh and bone, the pumping of blood and heaving of lungs long abandoned, the pictures registered by those glassy eyes, the memories of those quieted brains all gone, leaked out into the great Atlantic deep, every soul committed to the great Atlantic sleep, all their loved ones, relatives, and friends already gone, except perhaps one or two babies now over a century old. How did you reach into the minds and the fears and the premonitions of those men of long ago and those women of long ago?
Yeah. Look, some of it is just imaginative flights of fancy, I suppose. Some of it is because I've spent a lot of time at sea, and I've been very scared of the sea, and I've been in bad storms in difficult conditions in small boats. You know, I've got a lot of respect and a lot of fear around the sea. I also get quite a lot of claustrophobia. So to write a piece like that, I imagine myself in a small metal box under the ocean. And I immediately start channeling all those fears and premonitions. And another thing another inspiration was the movie Jaws, which as a child traumatized me completely. The idea of this dark force under the waves coming at any moment to eat you. So I, you know, some of those fears, I suppose, that they come through in the writing.
It was give you nightmares. I find when I'm very interested in the Titanic. I'm interested in other things that when I read about them at night, possibly with a few drinks in my hand, I find that I have terrible dreams sometimes, particularly as I get older. When I read about people in tragic situations, historical accounts that are quite vivid sometimes, you have bad dreams and you start having bad dreams. Andre Brink said He wrote a novel at one point. He had to leave the room as he was writing it. It was a novel called One Tongue Singing, I believe. And he had to leave the room because it was so, and it was a very violent novel. And he didn't like being in the same room as that computer where he was finishing off the novel. Anything like that?
No, I guess I do compartmentalize the writing. So when I get to my desk, I really switch on, and that's first thing in the morning. And when I leave the desk, I do try to switch off. So, I am able to box it. Yeah.
That's good. Look, not to provide any spoilers again, but there's a familiar battle going on here between the ships on the surface of the ocean and the German subs below. Yet you managed to make us feel sympathy somehow for both sides of the battle. One really wants the Submariners to survive, even though they are quite obviously the antagonist of the story. And you feel the danger they face. And we also see things from the perspective of the sailors and the merchantmen on the surface who know death lurks below. How did you make each side sympathetic to the reader? This isn't a case of British guys good, German guys bad, South Africans good, Germans bad. Everybody, as Tolstoy once said, a good novel is not about good versus evil. It's about good versus good. And that's what you've done here. That in those sections, you don't want the Germans to die. It's just like watching, I actually went and watched a bunch of sections of Das Boot where they're being depth charged. And it's just terrifying. And even though, historically, these are not the good guys. These are the bad guys. But we sympathize with them all the way to the end. Why? How'd you do it?
Yeah, well, firstly, why is because so many of those books that we read in the 50s and 60s, the Nazis were always the bad guy. They were these cut-out, two-dimensional, horrific, murderous bastards that everybody wanted to have lose the battle. And your square-jawed British upper-class heroic officer was often a fairly stereotypical character. And I did definitely want to depart from the genre in the sense that I wanted to create three-dimensional characters on both sides of the spectrum. The other thing is it's absolutely, and most novelists will tell you this, it's much more fun writing the villains. You get much more of a kick out of writing the bad guys, and that's certainly the case for me. I get a real lift when I'm writing the German chapters because I'm having to get my head inside the villains, which is I just think more fun. The other thing that that's happened to me is I have a lot of German friends and a lot of German friends who sail, and I windsurf with a bunch of Germans in Cape Town, and so when we're there sitting chatting on the beach and looking at the wind and the waves, I often imagine them 80 years ago on a German submarine, and these are regular decent blokes that have been thrust in the Second World War, 18 years old, coming from a little town in central Germany, having been indoctrinated, being forced onto a submarine. So through my German buddies who I went with, I kind of get an inkling, a little inkling, I think, of the kind of characters I want to create in a book like The Wolf Hunt.
They're a motley, dirty, but in many cases, very sympathetic lot on those subs. And of course, the men on the, and women on the, but mostly men, on the surface of the ocean are also, also in many cases, clinging to the very edge of sanity and endurance. One character who I'd like you to talk about just a little bit is the ocean itself. How does the ocean serve as a character in your novel, shaping the actions and the decisions of the English and the Nazi crews? How does it feature in seafaring novels in general? And I also have to ask, attached to this is towards the end of the novel, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, did sharks really attack the men who had been cast overboard during a raid as the boat sank? Were they actually being eaten by the sharks? That reminds me of the Indianapolis sinking off the coast of Japan after the delivery of the nuclear bomb, that famous speech that was in Jaws. What a scene, and something I really had to touch on. What sharks and the ocean and the role in the novel itself and your thinking and all your novels about the sea.
Yeah, it's a venerable tradition in English literature to have the sea as an antagonist, as a character, as a powerful, potent force, from Joseph Conrad all the way back and into the present. And I'm no different. I love the sea and respect the sea, and it is an important character in all of these novels. And I like to set the sea up both as the cruel sea, the antagonist, and in some scenes the sea is there fighting both the Germans and the British and the South Africans. It is the amoral force that can at any moment destroy all of them. But I also want the benign sea, the Sea of Durban, the Sea of Mozambique, warm tropical waters with dolphins at play. I want that sea as well. The sea of Simonstown, of Boulder's Beach, of the Admiral Father with a beautiful little crescent of green crescent beach and placid waters. So I do want both aspects of the sea. And as to the sharks attacking the sailors in the water, that is a very famous and perhaps the most horrific incident of a ship sunk in off our coast, and that was the Nova Scotia, sunk by U-177 off the KwaZulu-Natal/Mozambican coast. More than 1,000 people were killed in that, and a lot of them were taken by sharks before the rescuers could arrive. So there were about 1,500 or more people on board, and it took a couple of days before the first ship arrived, and all the people bobbing in the water, a lot of them either were killed by sharks or had limbs severed by sharks. So they were trying to fight the sharks off for a couple of days. It's too terrible, but of course it's fantastic material for a novel.
That I had no idea that it had happened. Reminds me of Crab Walk by Seabolt about the sinking of that passenger ship at the end of the war in the Baltic. And I had no idea and you've brought it up, that the U-boats are not only killing warships, but they're in maritime cargo ships, but they were also going after pleasure ships. They're going after cruise ships filled with passengers in their tuxedos and having nice dinners. And next thing you know, they're being eaten by the sharks. And I was very surprised to read that. And of course, you've, as usual, reality trumps fiction. I want to bring up a question I asked Damon Galgut in a similar podcast, not a similar podcast, but another podcast. There's many Western Cape locations named, ranging from Simonstown all the way to Saldanha. At one point, a submarine sees the Greenpoint, submariner sees the Greenpoint lighthouse in his scope. There's a dance held at the University of Cape Town. And I want to ask you the same question I asked Damon. Are South African writers taking back their places, their language, and even their slang, and letting overseas essentially learn as they go? After all, if a new reader knows where Cherbourg is, surely they can figure out where Table Mountain is.
Yeah, absolutely, Ron. I'm all for the taking back. And I suppose I look to Tim Winton, the wonderful Australian writer, as inspiration for this. He takes no prisoners. He gives you all the Western Australian slang and the plants and the birds and the scrub and the surfing terminology, and boy, you better get with it. And if you can't, go and look it up. And I love that. It's the South giving a little bit back to the North of our uniqueness and our slang. And the Cape is, you know, the Cape Coast, just from the fynbos and the birds and the strange names of the towns, Hondeklipbaai and places like this. I think it adds a wonderful texture and color and a local flavor to the text. What I do try to do, if the words are a bit funny for a foreigner, is I try and let the meaning come through by the context within the sentence, that you can sort of understand more or less what it means. And I also have a long glossary, so that's another way to feed your reader. But then I'm also happy for them to be forced to go and look up what fynbos is and what a lesser double collared sunbird is, and so on, because I do think it brings a unique local flavor, and I'm all for it.
So this is a Last question, but I think it's a question we're all going to be asking ourselves. This is a series, and it's been very successful. Both novels have been extremely successful, and long may it last. How many more Jack Pembroke novels are you planning? And then, by extension, how many more war novels are you planning?
Yeah, I've actually just finished writing the third one, and it has gone off to my British publishers. It tends to come out in England first and then in South Africa a little bit later. And that one is set in North Africa, so it's the El Alamein, Tobruk, Egypt, Libyan campaign of 1942. So that will be the next one, and it's about Jack Pembroke and his little ship running convoys from Alexandria to Tobruk. And then I've started tinkering with the fourth novel, which will be Malta, a convoy from Alexandria to try and get supplies through to Malta during the worst of the siege, when Malta was under threat of falling to the Italians and the Germans. And I might take a pause after that. There's certainly many more planned of these Jack Pembrokes. I probably could keep going with this for the rest of my career. I'm so fascinated by it. And there's so many brilliant stories. And the South Africans got up to so much all over the world. I mean, the South African Navy was involved in Burma and in the Madagascan campaign and in Greece and in Croatia. So I've got material that I could keep going with for a long time. For now, there's certainly two more are coming, and then we'll see after that.
So we can assure our listeners that all or both of the new novels will feature South Africans. If they don't take place in South Africa, there still is that South African connection.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's always going to be a South African ship and South African sailors. That's what I'm bringing to this genre. The World War II genre is enormous, and there are tens of thousands of novels out there. What I can bring to the party, which hasn't been done much before, is to bring the South African stories. And I think that's partly why it's doing well overseas, because it's such a well-trodden path. But what I'm bringing is new. It's not – British and American readers do not know about the little South African Navy fighting way above its weight and doing really good work in far-flung corners of the earth. So that'll be my small contribution to a very big genre.
Thank you very much for coming. And for listeners, The Wolf Hunt by Justin Fox is now available in all good bookstores and probably a few dodgy ones. I urge you to go out and get yourself a copy and enjoy this incredibly exciting new novel out by writer Justin Fox. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much, Ron.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.